And the New York Times, they are afraid of him. But what amazes me about you, Noam, is your profound humanity and your identification with the human race. The Talmud has a phrase for you and for many who have labored long and hard in the field. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. Help me to welcome Noam Chomsky.
Well, I know we don't have a lot of time, and I'm sure, without even asking, that you have plenty of things on your mind that you'd like to talk about, so I don't want to monopolize this. I'm going to say a few things and then basically turn it over to you, and I hope we can go on with the discussion, much more interesting for everybody. Just a side comment after what Blaise said. Don't feel intimidated about not having taken a graduate course in linguistics. There's nothing that I'm going to talk about or that I know about or that's relevant to these things that's beyond the level of an ordinary high school student. My grandchildren don't have much trouble with them without any advanced degrees. So it's all on pretty much what's understood is pretty much on the surface. And you're kind of, people are intimidated into believing that they can't understand, and that's part of the system of indoctrination that you ought to escape from. We're all aware that right at this moment, bodies are being mutilated and torn to shreds by infernal weapons. Unknown numbers of people, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, are facing the threat of starvation and slow death. They were at the edge of survival after a decade of sanctions, criminal sanctions, even before the attack started, and no one knows what the effect will be. Could be grim. Under circumstances like that, it is not easy for any of us, I'm sure, to try to step back and take a cooler look and ask how we got to this situation, where it's likely to go from here, and what we can do about it. But that's what I'll try to do, putting aside the scenes of horror that are all in the back of all our minds. With regard to the last question, what can we do? The answer is not just a lot, but virtually everything. We're unusually privileged. We're, by comparative standards, most of us remarkably have resources available to us that others don't have. We have enormous freedom. That's not a gift that was given to us. It's a legacy that was left to us by centuries of struggle, by centuries of people, most of whose names are completely forgotten, but who were the important people and the ones who created the freedom and the rights that we now have, and that will be taken away unless you constantly defend them. And there is, in fact, a major effort to take them away right now. They will be, unless they're defended. They can be extended, and they should go far beyond the changes. Even in recent years, there's been very striking and dramatic progress, and there can be a lot more. with regard to the current situation. We can do more to change it than anyone in the world. All of this should be truism. It's also kind of a truism that privilege confers responsibility. At that point, choices arise. You can face the responsibility, which may not be easy, but it's a lot easier for us than people in almost all the world. Or you can shirk the responsibility, in which case you're leaving the future to be determined by forces that are anything but benign. And it's not an exaggeration to say that that future may not be very long. They're pushing to the edge of survival. It's not an exaggeration. There have been crises in the past. The scale is quite different. Most of the people in the world, in fact, I'm sure the overwhelming majority, are praying that we will take that responsibility. There is just no other way, in the near future at least, to put a halt to a juggernaut that is regarded around the world with great fear and dread and often hatred. In fact, I can't remember a moment like this in history. Just see if you can think of one. I can't. When one great power with enormous means of violence at its hands was so hated and despised and feared. The war that's going on is called in the propaganda system the War of the Allies. The only thing they're allied, the only alliance is the alliance of Bush and Blair against literally the entire world. The world opinion is overwhelmingly opposed to the war. It's not just the war. It's opposed to what the war is. The war is understood as a symptom of something much broader, and the opposition is to the much broader phenomenon of which this war is just an instance. We know what it is. I mean, at this point, even before the war began, you could read last October in the national press that the world is more concerned about the unbridled use of U.S. power than it is about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. Opening article in the opening sentences of an article in the Christian Science Monitor last October, which is an understatement, because in fact the world was not concerned about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein because it didn't see any threat. They may hate even his neighbors, despise him, but are not afraid of him. They weren't afraid of him for very good reasons. They know that, as everyone who's paid attention knows, that Iraq was heavily damaged by the First Gulf War, the decade of sanctions, which were a truly criminal act. The UN coordinators were not exaggerating when they called them genocidal. Drove the society to the edge of survival, a large majority are on the edge of starvation. Iraq is the weakest country in the region. Its military expenditures and its economy are about a third those of Kuwait. Kuwait has 10% of its population, far below those of other countries in the region, and not even shouting distance of the regional superpower. The regional superpower is, in effect, an offshore military base of the United States and totally dominates everyone else in the region, namely Israel. That's a small country, but being a U.S. military offshoot, it's extraordinarily powerful. Hundreds of nuclear weapons. According to its own estimate, it has air and armored forces that are larger and technologically more advanced than any NATO power outside the U.S., let alone any country in the region. And people in the region don't have to be told that Iraq is not the... Even though Iraq has only partially conformed to a series of U.N. resolutions, there are other countries that have totally rejected many more U.N. resolutions, Israel's one of them, Turkey's another, Morocco's another. And those are very serious resolutions having to do with aggression, military occupation, violations of the Geneva Agreements, means war crimes in our terms. They know all that. And they also know something else, that the only reason that these countries are not in violation of more UN resolutions, and in fact more serious ones, is that the United States won't permit it. The U.S. vetoes them. The U.S. is far ahead of anyone else since the 1960s in vetoing Security Council resolutions. Britain's second. Nobody's within shouting distance. That brings up another point. If Iraq had the veto, how many UN resolutions would it be violating? Well, obvious answer, none. That means if any discussion of violation of Security Council resolutions even pretends to be serious, it's going to bring in the veto. Otherwise, it doesn't even pretend to be serious. You can ask yourself how often this has been brought up in the discussion of passionate discussions of Iraq's only partial compliance with a series of UN Security resolutions, Council resolutions. And the resolutions that the U.S. has vetoed, and remember, it's far in the lead, nobody's close except Britain, are very serious ones. It includes, for example, several resolutions calling on all states to observe international law, which the United States vetoed with Britain abstaining. It includes resolutions calling on the United States to observe the rulings of the World Court, the International Court of Justice, which condemned the United States for unlawful use of force. That means international terrorism in its war against Nicaragua, which Blaise mentioned. The U.S. simply disregarded it, vetoed the Security Council resolution, and a long series of others on a wide range of issues. These are not trivial matters, and it's not ancient history either. In fact, it's the very same administration which is in office right now. They're almost identical to the ones who ran the country in the Reagan-Bush administrations. These are serious issues, and the people in the region are well aware of it. They're also well aware that however much they may despise Saddam Hussein, he's not a threat. It's the weakest country in the region and far from the most serious violator of Security Council resolutions. Everybody ought to know this. This ought to be the front pages of independent media, if there were any. These are close to truisms. There's nothing obscure about these things. It's the kind of things you ought to learn about in high school, but you certainly ought to think about and find out about. They're important to know. Well, Saddam Hussein is undoubtedly hated and despised in the region. But by now, George Bush has accomplished a miracle. He's not only organized an international peace movement, as Blaise said, he's turned Saddam Hussein into a figure who is revered in the region. It's gotten to the point where the mainstream press is concerned about it. Been major articles in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and others in the last couple of days saying that the ones we're claiming to be liberating, the Arab and Muslim worlds, are in a total fury about this. There's a wave of revulsion against the U.S. war, which has extended the fear and hatred of the administration in Washington well beyond what it was before, and have even turned Saddam Hussein into a figure of reverence. They hate him. They know he's a thug and a despot and a killer. But at least he's standing up to the savage Americans, and he's the only one who's doing it. You can read in the mainstream press here that he's described with reverence by people in all walks of life in countries like Jordan, the closest ally of the United States, and by people right in the mainstream, Christian, wealthy Christian Arabs who say, okay, America is our enemy, we have to destroy them. Head of the Strategic Study Center in Jordan, very pro-American, was quoted recently, just a couple days ago, as saying that there is no doubt that in the Arab world, Saddam Hussein holds the high ground. And he was worried about that. because he knows what it means for countries like Jordan and Egypt and others. If they ever relax controls, if they ever allow the voice of the people to be heard, it's going to be the voice of radical Islamists who want to declare global war against the United States and secular nationalists who are very much into the whole U.S. International economic system, but agree with them. I agree with them that something must be done to stop this savage power, which there. Here we can turn to actual polls. There have been recent polls of the Arab world conducted by specialists at U.S. universities, which show that about 95% of the population from Morocco to through the Persian Gulf to Lebanon believes that the United States has no interest in the Arab world other than controlling its oil, protecting its offshore military base, Israel, and humiliating Arabs and Muslims, doing that by virtue of the fact that it possesses the force, the means of violence, that enable it to do anything it wants, to murder people from a safe distance, to kick them in the face, anything. That doesn't make friends. The Washington Post article about this a couple of days ago opens by saying things are happening in the Arab, things are brewing in the Arab world which do not bode well for the United States. That's quite true, that Bush is acting to create the basis for a reaction which is likely to be a reaction of expanded terrorism. They know they're not going to attack the United States. They can't do that. But they can do what international affairs specialists have been pointing out for a long time. They can develop weapons of mass destruction. They can carry out extensive terrorist acts, which are basically unstoppable. And that's exactly the consequences of the actions that are being taken, quite apart from what's happening to Iraqis and Palestinians and others, which they see, even though they're suppressed here. I mean, if somebody was watching this from outer space, they would be, could be forgiven for believing that George Bush was embedded into the White House, to use a contemporary term, as an agent of Osama bin Laden. I mean, if Osama, it's not a joke. I mean, if Osama's alive, he must be enjoying this mightily. You know, it's fulfilling his wildest dreams. It's creating a war between the evil empire and billions of people around the world who are terrified of it and want to destroy it. Well, you know, how did we get to this point? It was bad enough. It goes back quite a ways, but let's just take the, too much time, just take the very recent past. Let's begin with last September. A lot of things happened last September. One thing that happened last September is that the Bush administration released its national security strategy. That was an extremely important document. It sent shudders around the world and, in fact, right through the U.S. foreign policy establishment, like the next issue of Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal, had a pretty harsh critique of it. What did it say? Well, it was very brazen. The national security strategy said that the U.S. is intending to, the U.S. government is intending to rule the world by force. That's the dimension in which the U.S. has overwhelming advantages. By now, it probably outspends the rest of the world combined in military force and is expanding it in directions that are considered extraordinarily dangerous by everyone, like moving into weaponry in outer space. It's not dominant in other dimensions, but in force, yes, overwhelmingly dominant. The U.S. intends to rule the world by force and to do it permanently. Any potential challenge that is detected to U.S. dominance will be destroyed. That's the content of the national security strategy. It's been nothing like that in history. Nobody's ever said that. They may think it, you know, or they may describe policy that way, in fact have, but it's never been declared as official government policy before. There are precedents, and they're worth looking at. but nothing quite like this. Well, that frightened people, increased the fear that already existed. The fear was already great, increased it greatly. This is sometimes called a preemptive war doctrine. That's just propaganda. It's not a preemptive war doctrine. Preemptive war means something. A preemptive war, under charitable interpretations, falls within the existing framework of international law. Okay, so you, those of you whose memories are long enough, may remember that the present incumbents in Washington, one of the ways they kept the country terrified through the 1980s, as they did, one of them was to conjure up an air base in Grenada, which the Russians were going to use to bomb us. You know, fortunately, our brave cowboy leader saved us in time, sent 6,000 special forces who managed to overcome the resistance of a couple of dozen Cuban paramilitary workers with pistols, and actually got 8,000 medals of honor for it. And we were standing tall after that, if you remember. So we were saved. But for a while, it looked like the Russians were going to bomb us from Grenada, assuming they could find it on a map somewhere. Well, suppose they found it, and they had bombers there. And the bombers in Grenada were doing just what we were told they were going to do when everyone was supposed to be shivering. They were coming across the Caribbean to bomb Florida. Okay, if at that point the U.S. sent out planes to shoot down the bombers before they destroyed us, that would be legitimate under Article 51 of the U.N. Charter. That's preemptive war. This is something totally different. This is a doctrine that says we will attack anyone who we regard as a potential challenge. Nothing preemptive about that. Sometimes it's called preventive war, but that's not right either. It's not preventing anything. The only thing it's preventing is any potential challenge that the U.S. government invents, claims to be a challenge. That's just an open license to go to war with anybody and destroy anybody, which we can do because we have overwhelming power. And that's the way it's understood, and it doesn't make people comfortable. It did cause a wave of hatred and fear. This is, I think this is the most feared and hated political leadership maybe in history. It's hard to think of a counterpart. Well, that's one thing that happened in September. Another thing that happened in September is that it was the opening of the midterm election campaign. September was the opening of the campaign for the congressional elections. Well, the Republicans understood very well that they can't possibly win the elections if the issues are those that concern people, socioeconomic issues, basically. And the reason is they're cutting everybody's throat, and they'll get smashed if that's the issue. So they had to do what they did right through the 1980s. Through the 1980s, their policies were extremely unpopular. They were able to stay in, for good reason. They were able to stay in office by frightening people, and that's what they did again. Karl Rove just was kind enough yesterday in the New York Times to explain it, although it was obvious before. It was necessary to frighten people into believing that there's a threat to their security. In that case, they'll rally around the strong leader, the brave cowboy, another one, and they'll suppress their concerns over things like, where's my job, or what's happening to my pension, or how am I going to take care of my elderly mother, and so on and so forth. If those issues are, if they're voting on those issues, the administration doesn't have a chance. And as Rove just pointed out yesterday, if they want to pursue their domestic agenda, a very harsh agenda, which would change the, would return the country back to, 100 years ago, if they want to do that, they're going to have to frighten people. And that's correct. And they did. Starting in September, there was a drumbeat of propaganda about several things. First, that Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to our survival, just like Grenada in 1983, an imminent threat to our survival. Another was the constant insinuation that he was behind, he carried out or organized the September 11th attacks, and that they were planning new ones. Well, this was a spectacularly successful government media propaganda campaign. You can see it by looking at the polls. By the end of September and since, around 60% of the population believes that Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to U.S. security and survival. By now, over a majority think that Iraq was behind September 11th and is planning new things, that Iraqis were on the planes. If you go back before that, it was like 3%, and the whole idea is totally outlandish. And furthermore, these attitudes, these beliefs, are very highly correlated with support for war, and it's understandable. I mean, if I believed those things, I'd be in favor of the war, too. You know, if you think that Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to your existence, that he carried out the September 11th attacks, he's powerful enough to carry out new ones, yeah, there's an argument for war. And people in the United States are genuinely frightened. This is unique to the United States. No one else believes any of this. Even the neighboring countries that were attacked by Saddam Hussein is considered insane. You know. But here it dominates. And this is not the first time that it did work for the election, barely. If you take a look at the election, the Republicans managed to maintain power to pursue their domestic and international agendas by a very small number of votes, a couple of tens of thousands of votes. It was essentially a statistical tie, but just enough to maintain power. And they did it exactly this way. Polls show that people maintained their preferences, but suppressed their concerns over issues that matter in your life because they suppressed it below the security threat, so you rally around the leader. This is the story that went right through the 1980s. For these guys in office, it is absolutely second nature. They did come into office, as Blaise pointed out correctly and importantly, announcing a war on terror, which of course instantly became a major terrorist war. But they also started right off with threats to our existence. So in 1981, first year, the cowboy was hiding in the White House surrounded by tanks because Libyan hitmen were wandering the streets of Washington, you know, going to assassinate our leader. Miraculous escape from that one. Then came Grenada. There were other Libyan threats. In fact, he told us that told the country that Libya is trying to expel the United States from the world. They don't have small objectives. Then came Grenada. You know, going to bomb us from Grenada. Saved from that one. Then came Nicaragua, which was only 2 days' driving time from Harlingen, Texas. It was a cancer right in our landmass, as the moderate George Shultz, Secretary of State, put it. Told Congress, we got to save ourselves. Furthermore, they're following the script from Mein Kampf, he said, planning to conquer the world. Reagan declared a national emergency in 1985 because of the threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua. You know, I mean, people outside the United States were looking in amazement as all this stuff was going on, but it worked. Kept the population frightened enough to keep them in office. And it went on right through the 80s. 1988, George Bush was able to get elected by just pulling a straight race card. Willie Horton, you know, black criminal is going to rape your sister unless I get elected. Hinted, you know, it wasn't said in those words, but it was so close to the surface you couldn't miss it. Crime, people were terrified about crime. They were terrified about drugs. One thing after another. These are all problems, but they're no different than any other industrial country. And the United States has a level of security that's just beyond what anybody can even dream of. But the population is a very frightened population. This goes way back. It's easy to scare people. Worked in the 80s. They're doing exactly the same thing now. And it did succeed in building up enough support so that even though opposition to the war is enormous, and in fact it's never been this high, it was enough to sort of give them some kind of basis to go to war. That's an impressive achievement, and it also frightens people, you know, very much frightens them. I mean, today in the New York Times, you can, it's a big page showing pictures of Marines and others explaining why they're going to go to, why they want to go to war with Iraq and kill Iraqis. It's because they remember 9/11. Okay, now, you know, if somebody's watching this anywhere else in the world, they can only conclude one of two things. Either this country is so fanatically racist that if some Arab did something to you, you want to kill all Arabs. I mean, it's a level of racism that's pretty hard to imagine. Either that, or the country is so deeply indoctrinated that people believe what is clearly total nonsense. You can ask the editors of the New York Times which of those two messages they're trying to convey, but it's got to be one or the other. I can't think of a third interpretation. Okay, that frightens people. Let's go on. Congress in October did pass a resolution authorizing the government to use violence. I should stop. Yeah, okay. Pardon? Yeah, I'm going to. Okay, one more minute, and then I'll stop. No, she's right. She's right. They passed the October resolution. I'll be like 1 minute. Yeah. Passed the. You can ask questions of them. Yeah, we'll go on with other stuff. They passed a resolution authorizing force because of the threat posed by Iraq to the security of the United States. Virtually the 1985 national emergency reiterated annually about Nicaragua. And it goes on from there. I mean, a lot of pretty awful things happened in the next month or two. My dear leader tells me I shouldn't go on to talk about them, but they're worth knowing about. One more minute. Let me just run through a few things that happened in October. I mean, these are things that were either not reported here or barely reported. You can figure out for yourself how much you read about them. In October, there was a retrospective meeting, the 40th anniversary meeting of the missile crisis, Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. It was attended by key participants, high-level participants in the U.S., Russia, and Cuba. They knew at the time that it was a very dangerous period, the most dangerous moment in history, Kennedy's advisor, Arthur Schlesinger, described it as. What they found out last October just blew their minds. It turned out that the world was literally one word away from what would have been a terminal nuclear war. It was that close. Two Russian submarines were under, they discovered that Russian submarines had been under attack by U.S. destroyers. The submarine commanders thought a war was on, meaning a nuclear war. They had nuclear-tipped missiles, and two of the commanders ordered them sent off, which would have led to a devastating nuclear response, you know, wipe out Moscow. They respond by wiping out New York, and in a couple of minutes it's all over. The Eisenhower had warned even before that a nuclear war would destroy the Northern Hemisphere. It's not a joke. It was, why didn't it happen? Well, a third Russian submarine commander countermanded the order. That's why we're around to talk about it. It was that close. Furthermore, all of this is extremely timely. The Cuban Missile Crisis was the result of a campaign of international terrorism that the United States was waging in order to achieve what's now called regime change in Cuba. Same notions that are right in the headlines now. Quite a discovery. I mean, the fact that that isn't blaring headlines all over the place is pretty shocking. I don't think it was even reported here. You can check and see. Shortly after that, the UN passed two major resolutions late October, October 23rd. One of them reaffirmed the 1925 treaty banning biological weapons. The second strengthened the Outer Space Treaty to ban emplacement of lethal weapons in outer space. Okay, those weren't reported at all in the United States, at least according to a database check done by a friend of mine. Why? The United States voted against them. It voted against a reaffirmation of the 1925 treaty banning biological weapons and against the treaty banning placing of weapons in outer space. U.S. alone voted against them. Israel voted with the U.S., but that's reflexive. It's like the Ukraine voting with Russia back in the old days. That's unilateral, therefore it doesn't get reported. Is that important these days? No. A treaty banning biological weapons or banning the placement of lethal weapons in outer space, which are likely to do us all in. Yeah, really important. Important enough so that the press understands that it's much better that citizens not know about this. Much too dangerous if they do know. And you don't unless you really go to exotic sources. Shortly after that, the Bush administration terminated negotiations on a treaty to put enforcement mechanisms into a bioweapons treaty. There is such a treaty, but has no enforcement procedures. The Europeans and others are trying to put in enforcement procedures. At the last minute, the Bush administration told them, you're not going to do it. And in fact, there won't be any more discussion of it for at least 4 years. It's the next thing that happened. Then we go on to the war. There's plenty, with that going on, there's plenty of background for the fear and the hatred, which is enormous. International polls are just shocking on this. I won't go through them because there's lack of time. They're mostly not reported, but they're dramatic. Again, going back to that observer from outer space, assuming that I think outer space people are supposed to be male, so I'll call him him, assuming that he has some concern for the human species, he must be wondering with amazement how long a free people are going to allow this to go on. And the answer is not very long.
Join me again in thanking Noam Chomsky. We have to be out of here. We'll make it quick. We're going to have a few moments for questions. We have microphones on either side. Sorry. Please make your questions brief so that we have time. I think everybody here came to listen to Noam, so please make your questions direct and brief. I just want to remind you also that we do have to be out of the sanctuary at 5 o'clock. There's a service here, so let's keep it quick.
You see this microphone?
On either side, so we're going to go.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And we'll alternate.
Okay.
We'll start here.
Can we start over here? Yeah.
One question from each side.
Yeah.
This is a question here. One of those killed in the war was a Hopi woman from the Arizona reservation. For those who don't know, Hopi means people of peace or peaceful people. And I want to get your comments on why, after the U.S. Basically butchered the indigenous people, they continue to use their name as weapons of mass destruction. For example, the Apache, the Chinook, the Arapaho.
Yeah, tomahawks. Yeah. It's absolutely shocking. I mean, it is absolutely shocking, you know. I mean, it's as if the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, was naming its planes Jew and Gypsy, you know. I mean, it's indescribable. You don't know how to talk about it. You know, how can a culture accept this, naming your weapons of mass destruction after victims of genocide? You know, it's something that should really bother us a lot. You're right.
My question is, I've been talking to a lot of my friends and a lot of other people, and if I can characterize their emotion, I'd say that a lot of them feel kind of
There's something missing. And it's, in fact, there's a reason why nobody ever is allowed to look at history. If you take a little look at recent history, you'll see what's missing. There was an article in the New York Times, again, yesterday, asking, you know, what happened to the anti-war movement? It was so huge in the past. How come it's so small now? If you take a look at that article, the first date that it mentions is 1970. Okay. And it says, oh, there was a fantastic anti-war movement in 1970. How come it's not like that now? What it didn't say is what happened before 1970. And it's not because the reporter is concealing it. She probably doesn't know. You're not allowed to know that when you go to school. What happened is that, and this is so little, you know, it's almost unknown, but it's a fact. The war began publicly in 1962. It was in 1962 that the Kennedy administration publicly announced, not secret, that the U.S. Air Force is bombing South Vietnam, authorized chemical warfare to destroy food crops, were beginning to drive millions of people into what amounted to concentration camps. Now, that was after 7 years in which the U.S. client regime had killed maybe 70 or 80,000 people, and they couldn't control the population, so the U.S. went to direct aggression against South Vietnam. South Vietnam was always the main target of the attack. The rest of it was horrible enough, but it was peripheral. That's 1962. How much protest was there? Zero. You know, you literally couldn't get two or three people to talk about it in the living room. Protest didn't begin for years. I won't run through the story, but I mean, as late as 1966, early 1966 in Boston, pretty liberal city, we literally could not have public protests against the war because they'd be physically broken up with the applause of the liberal press by students, incidentally, marching over to smash them up. One of them in March 1966, we put in a church figuring that would be safe. No. Was attacked. The only reason it wasn't Arlington Street Church wasn't demolished was because there were a lot of police around. That's after 4 years of war. You know, by then hundreds of thousands of people had been killed in South Vietnam. There had been, you know, saturation bombing of densely populated areas. The war had extended to North Vietnam for a year. He still couldn't protest it because there were nobody was protesting. You know, later it got to be a mass popular movement, and in fact an important one. By 1969, around 70% of the American population regarded the war as, I'm quoting from polls, fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake. Incidentally, virtually no intellectuals. That's why you don't read that. What you read is it was a mistake. You know? But the population said, no, it wasn't a mistake. It was fundamentally wrong and immoral. And furthermore, people have kept that attitude right up to the most recent polls about a year ago, but not among the educated sectors. For them, it was a mistake, you know, cost us too much, benign intentions, went awry, and so on. Enormous split between the public and the educated classes. Yeah, so there finally was massive protest. This time is quite different. There's massive protest long before the war even started. That's a tremendous difference from 40 years ago. It's not the only difference. You know, the whole country became a lot more civilized in just about every respect you can think of. There was no women's movement back then. There was no environmental movement, you know, a couple of people maybe. There were no third world solidarity movements. There was no mass popular anti-nuclear movement. There was certainly no global justice movement. That's the last couple of years. There were no anti-sweatshop movements. I mean, just go across the board. All sorts of things have happened which have completely changed the country, including opposition to aggression and violence. And furthermore, the government is well aware of it. When the first Bush administration came in 1989, any incoming administration gets an intelligence review of the world situation. Well, usually it's secret. You know, maybe if you're lucky, you'll find out about it 40 years later. This one, a paragraph got leaked. It was barely reported, but it was very important, maybe because it was very important. And you should pay attention to it because it explains their thinking. It was about what the U.S. should do in a war against much weaker enemies. Okay? They're the only kind you get involved with, for obvious reasons of prudence. It said, in the case of a war against much weaker enemies, we must win rapidly and decisively, because otherwise political support will collapse. It's understood to be thin. It's not the 1960s anymore, when you could go on and massacre people for years and years without any concern about opposition. Now, you take a look at the interventions in the 90s, that's what it is. You want to intervene, you know, you first build up an image of some genocidal power going to destroy us or something or other, and then you win an amazing victory over a much weaker enemy decisively and rapidly, kind of what you're watching now. That's the only kind they can fight. That's an achievement. Now, these changes in the country did not, it's like the legacy I talked about before, they didn't come as a gift. You know, they came because people like you were out there in the working day after day to change the country. And it worked. It's a different country, a much better one. There are also efforts to drive it back. You know, guys with power don't like this. So, of course, they're not going to give up. They continue to fight their own war to drive it back. And if people who are concerned about these things give up, they'll win. Those who feel depressed about what just happened just don't understand. It's a major achievement, what happened. Not enough to have stopped this war, but totally different from in the past. That's and so.
Sadly, we have to be out of here. So we've got to get started on
this. Sorry. We have to say goodbye, but let me end on that. If you just think about that, that tells you what we can do.